Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 675. If you were in Detroit and or Milwaukee this past weekend, thanks for coming out to the live shows. Miss April Richardson and I had a great time. Got a picture of the Bronze Fonz in Milwaukee, which was great. Had some Slow's barbecue in Detroit. And the next couple of shows are in D.C. and Philly, and then Bonnaroo mid-June. So hopefully to see you out there for that. Let's go to the Nerdist Community Corkboard. Here's a podcast called Little Big Cast. That's everything PlayStation is discussed on live podcasts, including game nights, indie games, much more at twitch.tv/littlebigcast, and that's cast with a K. Check out the podcast live on Wednesdays at 4 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, or find the podcast on iTunes. Moving on, Jeff Peck Jr. has created a cool and unique way for record enthusiasts to store and display what record is playing. They come in two sizes. They hold either 5 or 25 records. You can find them at recycledsaints.com. And our buddy Ken Denmead, Geek Dad. He is, of course, a former Nerdist Podcast guest, episode number 99. He was in a significant bit of legal wrangling to get the Geek Dad brand back, but he has finally settled the issue. But there were legal bills, because that's how America works sometimes. And if you want to help him out, go to gofundme.com/geekdad or become an ongoing patron of Geek Dad at patreon.com/geekdad. But Ken's a good guy, and he wants you to make with the cool tech so your kids think you're cool, and help him out if you can. If you would like your event or thing posted to the Nerdist Community Corkboard, events@nerdist.com, or throw them in the comment threads of the podcast over at nerdist.com. This episode is Mr. John Cryer, who I've met a handful of times over the years and has never failed to be a lovely, lovely gentleman. He has written a book called So That Happened, a memoir, which is available now wherever books are sold. He was such a great guest. And again, another good guy. I know you're getting sick of me hearing me say, like, oh, this person's great, this person's lovely. But these are nice people. And Cryer is no exception. I am telling you, you're going to want Cryer to come over to your house. I don't know if you'll be able to get him to come over to your house, but if you can get him to come over to your house, then you will have had a successful day, my friend. Here's the Nerdist episode number 675 with the fantastic John Cryer. Katie, thing, please.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
A little scary.
This room?
Yes, very. Yeah,
it's deep. The brick. It's all the brick. The brick is means business.
The brick is very serious. Yes. But in general, it's. I think you'll find it to be a warm room, John.
Oh, good.
Which is here to.
Grill me.
No,
about, like
this isn't the
House
this isn't
appropriations
the this is not the British press.
Okay. Oh, they're fun, but they sound so cool when they're doing it.
They really do.
Here's Morgan. Fuck you. What is that? A journal? Is that a?
It's a guest book.
Okay.
All of our guests. There's Bill Gates. There's
nice.
Gillian Anderson drew a big vagina.
Vagina.
Yeah.
See, I don't. Yeah. So okay, I have a story about vaginas if you'd like later.
Later? I mean later.
In the broadcast, I will tell you. I don't. If I tell you now, it will feel forced.
We've already recorded.
Oh, this is recording, and you just heard me just unload on Piers Morgan.
Yeah,
I don't even know Piers Morgan.
We can cut that out
but
if you want.
Fuck him.
Okay. Good.
I got nothing against Piers Morgan. No, the vagina story I was going to tell is not about my own vagina. My daughter, we've tried to demystify the whole thing for our children and not, you know, call it a hoo-ha and make up cute words for it. Just call it what it is, you
right.
know, and so that my daughter doesn't feel like it's dirty or something
right.
like that. So But she, of course, is now 5 and understands there is comedy value.
Thank
in
God
the
you
word.
Weren't like, she's 24.
I know. And she's 24. And we screwed her up
We're
for
trying
life,
to demystify the whole
thing. Finally.
Finally,
we're
it's
finally
okay.
Finally demystifying
okay.
it. But she's 5 and she's realized there's certain comedy value in the word vagina, which I think is also, I think a lot of people in stand up have realized
of course, yes.
the comedy value of vagina. So now she's saying it just to get a laugh at dinner table, you know, and stuff like that. And we're trying to sort of now ignore it and not make it this hugely powerful, funny word. But we're trying to ignore it. So my daughter has sort of upped her game. She has created a character with her vagina that she calls Vagina Fish Lips. And Vagina Fish Lips talks, and so she does the whole thing with...
Is your daughter Sarah Silverman?
You'd think she has a promising career in this. But the funny thing was, my daughter bonded great with my wife. And so she was always a little threatened by me and my relationship with my wife, you know, because we were totally dig each other. And so my wife, hello, hi, welcome. So my wife, so she would always, so my daughter was not always very welcoming to me.
Sure.
You know, she would always say, no, go away, daddy, go away, daddy. You know, that was what she said for several years. But interestingly, this character she created, Vagina Fish Lips, is very nice to me and will talk to me before bedtime. And go, oh, good night, daddy. You know, and it's very, very sweet of her. Your listeners didn't need to.
It's a good story because I'll tell you why.
This.
Because there's two things. There's two things that I think are intriguing you at it. Number one,
okay.
People mm-hmm. with young children who are trying to demystify. Because by the way, with what kids are growing up with now, it's like they're gonna, as soon as they are conscious beings, they're gonna have this stuff thrown in their face because of just the way the media is and the internet. And so having this demystified and also. You know, we have a chance with this generation to bring them up in a healthy sexual identity atmosphere,
yes,
as opposed
exactly.
to when we were growing up, where it was sort of like, be ashamed, you
yes,
know? Like, so
yeah.
Actually, I think it's actually a very good story.
Oh, thank you.
And I also
you.
Think it's very cool that you're not like, what are you doing? You know, that's not supposed to do that.
No, because at the bottom of everything, I'm a comedian and I enjoy good work.
Yeah,
you know, she's funny. She's a funny little 5-year-old girl.
And you, so you had a child when you were 45? Is that right?
Yeah.
And how? Because
I'm 44, I guess, because I'm turning 50 tomorrow.
Tomorrow?
Yes.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. You guys. You didn't have to get... Oh, wait.
We didn't get
you
anything. Yeah. No. So actually, the expectations were right on track. So this is today. The day that we are recording this is April 15th. So the 16th is your birthday.
Yes.
This won't go out for a couple of weeks to land in time with your book. But... because I'm 43, but I don't have any kids. But I kind of think like I could still do. I'm not opposed to the idea. So
capable?
Do you have any other guy like Tony Randall had kids when he was 70?
Yes, he is the measure by which all old guys are
possibly
are,
gay, and he still
and
has
he still
kids? Yeah. So
no, he was an effeminate heterosexual dork like me.
You are the Tony Randall of this generation.
I am the Tony Randall of this generation. I was a pioneer in my field. Well, just for my generation, actually. But Ducky was an effeminate heterosexual dork. We must unite.
Ducky was my, like, in terms of, you know, because of the way that I grew up, nerdy, awkward kid, you know, I always related to the Anthony Michael Hall character, the Ducky Ducky. Like,
yeah.
I saw all of your movies. I mean, going back to No Small Affair, to Hiding Out, to Pretty in Pink, like always, I was Hot Shots. Like I was a huge John Cryer fan growing up. So because I identified with you as this character who was sort of like out of place with the rest of what would have been considered popular culture, but you still managed to make stuff cool.
Oh, good. Not on purpose.
Teddy Z was a really fun show.
Thank you so much.
Yeah,
we were trying something that I don't know that we landed on that show. I think like Larry Sanders' show really landed what we were trying to do. You know, but we were on CBS, you know, 3 years before, so it was a lot harder.
Wasn't Alex Rocco on that show?
Alex Rocco was in that. It was great. He won an Emmy for that show, which was pretty exciting. Yeah, and he's so lovely. Such a great guy. But thank you for going over my filmography.
Yes, you started pretty young.
My first job was 19 years old in a Robert Altman movie called Ocean Stigs that you haven't seen.
That I didn't see. Yeah,
that nobody has seen because it's not good.
But it's a Robert Altman film.
I know. You'd think it was his stab at making sort of a youth movie.
Yeah.
And you know he did MASH. He's the guy's capable of being super funny.
Sure.
You know. But Ocean Stigs was based on a bunch of National Lampoon articles about these two guys who were just total, I don't know what you'd call them, vandals. Or, you know, they loved destroying the suburbia around them. And it was sort of a comment on Reaganism and all that stuff. But the movie just never quite worked. I mean, we would shoot the movie during the day, and then Bob would have these big screenings at night of all the rushes from the day before. Rushes. I now sound elderly.
This was on reel to reel, correct?
Yes. They were black. There was no sound.
No sound. He hired a piano player.
Yes. Oh, it's a scary part. He would have this great party atmosphere to show us all the rushes, and we would watch what everybody shot during the day, and it was largely an improvised movie. We would. We had a script, but he would basically mic up all the actors and set them loose on the set to make it up, which was scary but great. I mean, it's Robert Altman's entrusting you to do this. So we would watch the dailies and just laugh and laugh our asses off. We just thought this was hilarious. But when it cut together, it just lacked any context, and the movie just did not work at all.
So it's basically just a series of sketches that didn't really
connect. It's not even sketches. It's just people wandering around saying whatever comes off the top of their heads.
Is this available anywhere? Can people see this?
Yes, it's on a DVD. But it does exist. But it's not good.
Was there a premiere for this movie?
No, there wasn't a premiere. No, as a matter of fact, it was unreleasable. It was considered unreleasable, and it was only put out like a video company bought out a chunk of MGM, and they put out all their videos that they could, and it was one of them. But it was unreleased up to
that
point.
See, this is why people should go easy on themselves. Even Robert Altman has a turd in the punch bowl.
Oh my gosh! And what a turd! Check it out if you ever. You should probably smoke some weed or something, something to take the edge off that.
But then No Small Affair, I think, was the first movie I saw with you and Demi Moore, right? You were a young photographer and she was a model and you were in love with her.
Yes.
And then you guys ended up.
Yeah,
but I can't remember how it ended.
It was supposed to be sort of a May-December thing. She was supposed to be an older woman, and I was supposed to be, you know, young and still in high school.
But literally like 17 and 23. Like,
yes, it was really minor age difference. Well, the movie actually got started a year before with a different director and with Matthew Broderick and Sally Field in it. So there was actually a little more of a May-December thing.
Oh, that is a much more of
exactly.
a graduate style.
But by the time it actually got shot, it was me and Demi, you know, isn't that the normal course of events? At any rate, but that was, and Tim Robbins was in that movie.
Oh,
you
wow.
It was like, what?
He had a string, because he was also in Tapeheads, and he was like, he was in a bunch of these 80s movies where he was sort of like the lanky, hilarious, goofy guy.
Yes.
And then after The Player, just like, super serious.
Super serious all the time. Yes.
Yeah.
I wanted that phase. That phase never happened to me.
Did you want that?
Nah. It's not fun. You know, being able to do comedy is a gift, you know, because the serious stuff, honestly, it's weirdly, the stakes are kind of lower when you're acting drama.
Yeah.
Because you just, I don't know. You're not obviously if it's a comedy and it's not funny, you blew it,
right?
but if it's a drama and you know there's a couple of imperfect moments, it's okay, you know. So it's a little less precise,
yeah.
I think.
And with Pretty in Pink, I know John Hughes wrote that. I think Howard Deutsch directed that.
Yes,
right. So did you work with John Hughes at all?
Yes, he was a presence. He was not there every day, but he was there many days. And it was interesting because Howie didn't have the same style of directing as John. Howie was incredibly warm, and you felt like he was your best friend, and. And, you know, he'd come back after – he'd come – you know, we'd shoot a scene and then he'd say, hey, is there anything you want to do? And I would just go in and make some stuff up, you know. And that was fun. That was a really great way to work. And John wanted that sort of give and take as well. But he was capable of sort of messing with your head a little bit. I mean, I remember there was a scene and I talk about it in the book where there's a scene in a nightclub where – me and Molly Ringwald and Andrew McCarthy and Annie Potts are having an argument around a table. And it's a little frustrating when you shoot a scene with multiple characters at a table because you got to get close-ups of everybody, and that takes a while.
Right.
Unless you've got multiple cameras, and we didn't at that point. So we started with Molly's single, and then Andrew's single, and then Annie Potts' single, and I think Dweezil Zappa was in it
as well.
Yeah. And so by the time we finally got to mine, Molly and Andrew started screwing around behind the camera and like changing the lines and insulting me. And this was weird, you know. I was like, what is going on here? And it was an argument scene. So, you know, that sort of fed into the anger of it. And after the scene, I took Molly aside. I was like, what the fuck are you doing? You know? And she said, oh, well, John told me to try and make you angry because the scene wasn't percolating enough. And I was like, then I really got angry.
You're like, you could just tell me.
Exactly. You just make it a little hotter. That's what you say in that situation.
I am a performer.
Yeah. But it was an interesting bit of sort of Machiavellian, manipulation. And apparently John was a tough guy to get close to, and I, you know, with my interaction with him was always always genial. I was a huge fan of his from his writing at National Lampoon, and actually he had there was a story that I loved that when I went in for my audition for Pretty in Pink, I mentioned to him. I was like, oh, I love that story. It was a it was called The Spy Who Wore Nothing. And it was basically this, you know, 15-year-old boy is asleep at night in his room and a naked woman climbs in through his window. And it turns out that his memory's been erased. He's actually a deep cover secret agent. And then they go on this adventure together while he's with this naked woman. And it's, you know, it was like the ultimate 14-year-old boy's fantasy. So, of course, I was a big fan. And he later confided in me that he had taken that idea and sort of changed it and written it as a new script called Some Kind of Wonderful. that was the movie that he was talking to me about after Pretty in Pink.
But
and for a while, exactly. And for a while, I was going to be in Some Kind of Wonderful. But then, and it's a long, torturous story that I go into in the book, but... Howie managed to make John angry. Howie Deutsch was supposed to direct that one. John got angry at him about something, and all of a sudden wasn't the director anymore. They brought in a new director, Martha Coolidge, who rewrote it, and then they cast Eric Stoltz while she was the director. But then they fired her and brought Howie back. And by that time, the story was Pretty in Pink all over again, but it had not started out that way at all.
I think Martha Coolidge directed one of my favorite movies of the 80s, Real Genius.
Real Genius, yes, yeah. The Val Kilmer movie.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there was I'm kind of curious to know what it was like to, I mean, the term Brat Pack was thrown around quite a bit in the 80s as being the group of like of basically
the cool kids.
The cool kids. It was like the Breakfast Club group. You know, it was Rob Lowe and Molly and
Judd Nelson and Emilio Estevez.
And you were part of that too, because like you,
I wasn't really
not the inner. But
yeah, exactly.
You were part of it.
Yes, I was part of it, and there was a writer recently writing the history of the Brat Pack in those 80s movies, and she called me, so I guess I'm a part of it. but at the time, if you recall, when they coined the term the Brat Pack, it was negative. It was very – because it was like, look at these bunch of assholes.
Really?
You know? Yeah, you don't
I don't remember. I just – because I was the right demographic.
Oh, so you – so it was like right above you.
Yeah,
because
everyone
right
was really
you.
Fucking cool and really really awesome, and it – was but was it what without social media like in the 80s what was it like to be a famous movie actor in the 80s
well it was awesome I mean that's the perfect choice of words for it as well at that time though the Brat Pack actually sort of came about as a terminology from an article written about what sounded like a kind of annoying interview that this writer had with Rob Lowe and Emilio Estevez and Judd Nelson. And so they immediately got this – it immediately had a negative connotation at the time. But it's nice to know that there was – that connotation was absent – for a lot of people.
I didn't get that at all. I was the right demographic for all those movies, and they all like I landed right squarely in the middle of
awesome.
All the things that I loved. But I way more identified with this sort of awkward, out of place, nerdy characters because that was me. Like that's mm-hmm. how I moved a lot when I was a kid. So mm-hmm. I was always like, I don't really fit in with anybody.
Yeah.
So it was they were greatly appreciated. But it's not, you know, and not everyone survived that. Not everyone really survived that era.
Yeah, it was interesting because it was the combination of extreme fame and drugs, you know, the availability of drugs, and that was part – that was considered kind of an acceptable part of the culture.
Was that – were you into that part of it?
No, I was not. So it was always a little weird for me because, you know, everybody – when they were going to go out and party, I wasn't going to get invited.
Right.
Which was actually probably par for the course at that point. But no, as a matter of fact, there was a point because I was, you know, in talking about ideas for the book when I was writing the book, I was going to write a whole chapter about the number of you know, very exuberant drug users who never offered me drugs. Nobody ever – I've made it through the entire 80s without ever getting offered drugs. You know what? It took Andy Dick in 1993 to finally offer me some drugs.
He's really breaking a lot of ground.
Exactly. And I thank you, Andy Dick, because finally somebody was willing to
– Also, please take care of yourself.
Yes, exactly. Please, good luck, Andy. But he was trying to make out with me at that moment, so –
Well, he's offered you something.
Exactly. It was, you know, it was part of a plan of seduction, I suppose.
Yeah. Now, if Rob Lowe had whipped his penis out,
that would have made it an evening,
right?
As far as I'm concerned.
Did you? So you were never at any of the crazy? I'm just kind of curious to know, like, what was the craziest thing you saw at like a weird 80s party? Because I think in the 80s is like. People don't give a fuck about anything. They'll just do whatever.
There's
it's
no
just,
rules.
It's coke and unprotected sex, and no one gives a shit about it.
No, that's the thing, though. But the 80s were never that big bacchanal for me. In fact, I went to the Playboy Mansion really hoping for that and had a lovely, surreal evening. The only person who I had even a shot with was the paraplegic playmate because they made an effort to diversify.
Of course.
But alas, she was too drunk. And it just felt like, no, you know what?
You cannot, you cannot hook up. There's no part of you that if you ever, even a remotely decent person, you cannot hook up with a drunk paraplegic person.
No.
If they're
drunk people
out
in general.
Of it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Drunk people, two things you shouldn't. When I went to the Playboy Mansion the first time, I thought it was going to be really crazy too. And I spent most of my time just staring at the monkeys in the cages.
Exactly. The
That's
monkeys.
That's what I enjoyed.
And it is fascinating. There was a girl there who was said, oh, you want to see the game room? I'm like, oh, yeah, do I want to see the game room? And it was a game room. Yeah. And there was Jonathan Silverman playing pinball.
I managed to avoid getting any type of airborne HPV at the Grotto, which
congratulations.
Which was, thank you very much. Yeah. And, I've only been there once or twice.
Okay.
And I was like, I get it. Yeah, I'm good. Uh-huh. I think I'm good now. but surviving that period and then having an amazing career continue from that. I mean, it's not like you don't just work. You haven't just worked a little bit. Mm-hmm. I mean, you were on the biggest sitcom, one of the biggest sitcoms in the history of television, which is you knowing how hard it is to even get on a show.
Uh-huh.
That's a whole other thing.
Yeah, and that was, you know, the universe aligned, and that's what happened. You know, a portion of the book is talking about how sort of you get the parts you're destined to get. You can't beat yourself up over the parts that you don't.
Right.
Because, you know, like part of the book is I talk about the things that I auditioned for but did not get, but that I'm happy for because the things turned out so well.
Right.
Like I auditioned for Chandler Bing in Friends, you know, but I love Matthew Perry. I auditioned for Mr. Pink in Reservoir Dogs, but I love Steve Buscemi, you know, and I auditioned for Karate Kid, you know, but I'm glad
but
it wasn't me.
But you love Pat Morita.
Yes, I love Pat Morita, so.
Come on.
That joke has been made before.
I know. No, that was the first time.
No, that was the first time. Okay.
That was the first time. You as Nucky Thompson, I sort of like this idea of
Thank you, Nucky Thompson, and you in Boardwalk. Thank you.
I mean, because honestly, you take a good comedy actor and you put them in like an intense drama role, and it's a lot of times.
Yeah, sometimes it can really work. I mean, Bryan Cranston.
That's
you know.
Vince Gilligan. Yeah. Like, most of the people that were in Breaking Bad were comedy people.
Yeah. Well, Gone Girl, I thought, had very nice use of formerly comedic actors.
So is this are you seeing this are you going to start taking weird roles in movies?
I've actually always done weird roles. There's a movie I did called Glam, where I only took it because the part involved me getting beaten to death by a shirtless Tony Danza.
Yeah,
I don't see that. Yeah, done. You had me at.
I don't even need to meet with the director. Why exactly. are we not shooting this right now? Why is this not being shot as we're speaking?
Exactly.
But I always think of you know, with all the drama that percolated from your show, like the real life drama, I always felt bad for you in the sense I'm like, God damn, it's fucking hard enough to get a show on the air. It is hard enough to have a hit show. Can everyone just act normal so we can try to enjoy this gift that we've been given, which happens usually, if it happens at all, once in a lifetime.
Exactly.
Maybe could, you know, sometimes it could happen a second time, but really, you know, as far as you know, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity. Why is everyone trying to fuck this up?
That did come to mind a few times.
Can we just show up to work?
Yes, exactly. You know, one of the reasons I wrote the book was that I realized how many strange experiences I've had in the business, and I realized they all sort of culminated with my 2.5 Men experience, and it is interesting. People in the business have that issue. They're like, oh, you had it in your hand. How could you throw it away like that? But people out of the business just sort of assume we're all going to work all the time and that this stuff happens to us all the time.
Right.
And they're just kind of entertained by how ridiculous it is, which made me sad because at that time, I was sincerely worried about Charlie Sheen dying.
Yes.
You know, and I thought, this is not actually entertaining, folks. You know, this is a person in really bad shape. So,
by the way, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it just like that point right there is where, you know, where I think the tabloids have, I mean, you know, it's fine to be like, who wore this dress better? Great.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you put people like Lindsay Lohan, Charlie Sheen, when you put these people under the microscope and like punch them and punch them and punch them and punch them and punch them, you have to remember, like, you might be contributing to some of this.
Exactly.
Like, these are destructive people. Yeah. And you're basically antagonizing someone with an illness,
in the hopes that they will become more ill and give you more
stories. So it's kind of gross. So,
yeah.
When you first started the show, did you sort of feel like, even during the pilot, where you're like, I don't know. Or was he totally cool?
No, he was sober. Actually, in fact, the we did a photo shoot. The very first photo shoot for a new show is always a little awkward because you haven't really done – you haven't been the characters really for any length of time. You've maybe shot the pilot or whatever. And so – but you've got to pose and you've got to have the sort of physical relationships that you have with people. So it was a little weird. But it was – but, you know, there was Angus T. Jones, all of, you know, 9 years old and Charlie and I. And at one point, Charlie asked me what date it was. And I said, it's the 14th. And he said, oh, I've been sober for 2 years now.
Oh,
you know?
Wow.
And he was proud of it. And I really liked the fact that he wasn't counting days. He was now into his years, you know. And for the first few years of the show, he was sober. So he was a different guy.
And you must have known him from Hot Shots.
Yes. When we did Hot Shots, he was clearly still partying, but he hadn't sort of – it hadn't – I don't know. It hadn't gotten out of control at that point. I think at that time he was sort of on a rebound of a – you know, he had some career problems and gone a little – too deep, and he was now getting clean and trying to get his act together for this movie, for Hot Shots, if you recall, and so he was great. He was great to work with. He would come in the trailer, say hello to everybody, super friendly. I'd hear tales about where he was the night before, but couldn't see it from his work at all.
Sure.
And you know, it, as I said. Because I gave off the vibe of a guy who wasn't doing drugs, I didn't participate in those kind of things and I wasn't asked to go out to the parties.
Sure. I find that to be a very fortunate happenstance for you.
In the end, absolutely. Yeah. At the time, I managed to be hurt.
And you know, performers are very sensitive, and yes, we want to be included.
For a while, I was going to call the book No Coke for Ducky. I just forget the cover was... Yeah.
Guys, surely someone has a punk band or an alt-rock band out there that needs to be called No Coke for Ducky.
Yes, exactly.
So you started the pilot and you started the show, and he was totally cool. Everything seemed fine. Angus was an adorable little kid, and it's like everyone like, oh, hey, we're doing it. So how long in before it was like, I don't know.
It was probably 3 or 4 years. It was actually. In the book, I go into the little indicators that should have told me something was off. You know, the first was the radio interview about 9/11 conspiracies that he gave. I don't know if you recall that, because I was listening to it on they talking about it on K-Rock and played chunks of it as I'm driving into work, and I'm like, wait a minute here, what is going on with? And before that, I had seen nothing, we parked next to each other at the studio. So I got out of my car, and he was just sitting outside of his trailer having a smoke. And I was like, "Hey, man, what's going on?" He was on the phone because, you know, of course there were people were all a Twitter about it. It was before Twitter.
Before Twitter, yeah.
Pre-Twitter Twitter. I said, "Dude, what are you talking about?" And he stood by it and said, "No, you know, they're hiding things from us, and they're this and that." And then I sort of broke it down and said, "Okay, you understand how if you wanted to do what they did, it would be impossible to plan because it was so hard, you know." We just argued about it and argued about it in the makeup room and it was interesting because the dynamic when you're, you know, he's a star of the biggest show on TV at the time, and so nobody was willing to say you're starting to go crazy,
right?
You know. So there was a surprising amount of support in the makeup room for 9/11 conspiracies that day.
Oh, wow.
But I understand, because who's going to say, you know, the person dabbing on, you know, his concealer isn't going to say, "Charlie, you're nuts."
Right. right.
So, but it was fascinating. Between that and then when his divorce with Denise happened, and you know, there were little indicators all the way along the line.
Were you guys really good friends at that point, or just
we
like
were, we were great work friends, but and we made some efforts to socialize outside of work, but you know, he had two daughters, and you know what happens a lot of the time when you've got kids is you just cocoon and you don't end up socializing nearly as much as you used to, and that's the phase he was in at the time, and I just assumed, oh, he's doting dad, you know,
right?
But obviously, after he and Denise split, it got very different.
And did anyone at any point say, like, should we have an intervention or should we do something?
That happened years later. That happened in like the seventh season. Chuck Lorre, the producer of the show, who's, you know, been sober for years and could obviously see the signs, took me aside and said, please, John, can you talk to him? Because I think he'll listen to you. And I don't know that he would, because I was never a party buddy, you know.
Right.
I was his work buddy. And so we respected each other. We really liked each other. But, you know, even though I was absolutely willing to talk to him about it, you know, I don't know how much good it would have done. And interestingly, he asked me to talk about it. And I said, okay, I'll talk about it tomorrow when we're at rehearsal together. And the next day, Charlie went into rehab.
Oh, okay.
So I was like, okay, I don't, well, that, you know, that was an awkward situation I won't have to deal with. But then a year later, he asked me to talk to him again, and that's when he and I sort of had it out. And he, you know, and I was, at the time, he sounded like he got me and got what I was saying and was going to make a change, and it just didn't work out that way.
Is there some sort of a strange, I mean, like, if you can, just sort of walk me through a little bit, when you're in a scene, you have all this other stuff weighing in the back of your head. You know that there's very serious shit going on. You know that he has problems, potential health problems, maybe mental health problems, drug problems. But, you know, you're still making, you know, for all intents and purposes, like a fun, wacky comedy. What's it? So is a live audience there?
Yeah, it's okay. A live audience.
So how are you sort of mashing all that down and kind of almost like when you're in a bad relationship and you're in front of your friends and everything's like, hey, no, everything's great.
Yeah.
You know, like, is that literally you're just like got to focus and do the work?
There was a certain amount of that. There was a Charlie was after he was arrested in Colorado, he was sincerely worried that the audience, you know, the studio audience would not laugh at him anymore, not find any of this stuff funny, because we still used a lot of his persona in the show. And we were all nervous. We were all, you know, sort of saying, well, is this going to be funny anymore to people, you know? And it was a fascinating reaction, because when they opened the curtain and revealed us at the beginning of the show, you know, which is we always come out and take a little bow and introduce ourselves, the ovation for Charlie was cacophonous. It was it was like everybody in the room suddenly had to take a side, and so they decided they were all on Charlie's side, you know. And it was a really odd experience to go, wow, you know, what exactly are they clapping for at this moment? I think it's when you're in the room with the guy, you know, they're not just going to sit there and be silent. It's not going to be crickets, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I think people like a
bad boy, you know?
Yeah,
like,
on some level. I don't think they realize, like, how dangerous that actually is. So they're kind of like, yeah, he made it through. And also, I think, if anything, sort of worked in favor for at least the public, at least the way the public saw it, I think, is that it was kind of within his character in the show, in a weird sort of way. Of
yes,
just like,
exactly. So he was on brand.
He's living it. Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
It's not like he was playing Felix Unger, you know.
I was playing Unger.
You were playing Felix. You know, like so in a way, it's almost like, yeah. And I don't know, people tend to embrace that the people who kind of embrace their dark side, I guess. I don't know. I, the whole time I was watching, I was like, these people don't know what they're supporting.
Yeah, he's a fantasy figure for a lot of people.
Yes.
He is a fantasy figure. And like his live tour was, you know, a sort of symbol of that, you know, that there was an actual audience to just see him ramble, you know. And, you know, if they pay their money, great. God love them.
Did you give up emotionally at a certain point? Because you can only try to help so many times, and you're just like, I can't do this anymore.
Oh, yeah. And that was, yeah, that, the, I gave up after when they had started to try and recast his character on the show. He started writing really angry, you know, even more so.
Was that the Tiger Blood things, or was that?
No, that was actually after.
That was after Tiger Blood.
It was even worse.
Okay,
and that's when I gave up and said, I don't know this guy anymore.
Yeah, and have you spoken to him since?
Yeah. We are on speaking terms. In the book, I talk about some of the process of talking to him, I wouldn't say that we're close, but he knows about the book, and he seems like he's okay with it. He hasn't said anything, the guy I knew was sober. You know, and if he makes that decision and wants that to be his life, then I'd be happy to welcome him back into my life.
Well, the other thing, too, is that, you can try to help someone. You can't make anyone do anything. But then also at a certain point, you kind of got to protect yourself because you have a family, you have a career, you have you can try to a certain extent. But if someone is just such a toxic, like, tornadoes don't build houses. You know what I mean? Like, tornadoes.
Yes.
Tornadoes carve a path of destruction.
Yeah.
And my dad had this saying where he was basically like, "You put a negative and a positive in a room, and the negative's always going to win." Like, the chaos. It's difficult to reorient the chaos. You know, like if something is going to be super chaotic and you can't, at a certain point, you got to be like, well, you know what? Fuck, I have a wife. I have a family. I can't.
I got to move on. But I wish him well.
Yeah. I mean, that's the most you can do.
Be truly happy for his success and whatever good things happen for him in the rest
of his life. So please, I assume you're okay with talking about this stuff because a lot of it is the focus of the book.
Yes. Well, it's three chapters out of 27. So there's other stuff, but yes, and I'm cool with it.
What was your reaction to this sort of weird little, Angus Jones flip out?
Oh yes, that was exciting. No, that was great because Ashton Kutcher, who I'd been working with for a little less than a year at that point, he'd never been through one of these things before. So I was welcome to 2.5 Men, Ashton. I got this knock on my door, my trailer door. I opened the door and Ashton is there and he's kind of hollow eyed and and lost looking. And he said, "Hey man, you hear about Angus?" And I said, "No, is he okay?" And he said, "Sort of." And he said, come to my trailer. And so I went to his trailer, which was gargantuan, and he showed me the video of Angus denouncing the show and calling it filth. And that was a jaw-dropping moment because up to that point, Angus had been the sweetest, a lovely little kid who had this astonishing gift for remembering lines and for taking notes at the last minute and altering his performance and as an actor he was great because he wasn't trying too hard, he was just being, and it was just a wonderful presence, and he was a lovely kid for so long, and to just for him to in that particular manner reveal how he'd been feeling about the show for a while was really shocking. But he's a deeply good kid, and in some respect, I understood because he was this sweet little boy in the middle of a fair amount of chaos.
Of course.
And that a kid so well-intentioned would discover, a deeply held Christian belief was not hard for me to believe. All the best parts of that were who he is.
Sure.
And so... So that part of it did not surprise me. Just the manner in which it came out felt a little sort of manipulated, like the people in his church were trying to get him on tape saying this kind of thing, and that was not cool. But he's a good guy, so he came and he auditioned. He apologized to everybody, And it was clearly sincere. He, you know, while he still felt the way he felt, he didn't mean to hurt anybody's feelings. He made the tape. He thought it was an internal video for the church.
Sure.
He didn't think anybody was going to see it.
So naturally, he gave all the money back, right?
Yes. Well, no, that I understand why people would be angry about that.
I mean, there's nothing, by the way, I want to make it very clear. I don't have any problem if someone's going to say, like, you know, mm-hmm. I've discovered this faith, I believe this thing, and these are my beliefs. Great, those are your beliefs. But at the same time, you're like, but you
took the money.
But I also, when I saw that, I think my forgiveness meter was more in a, he's a teenager.
Yes.
You know, kids have a lot of different identities. Yeah. Maybe this will be the one that sticks. Maybe it won't. He's trying, trying to figure out who he is, particularly in a business that is very unstable. And because of, like, what you said, you know, it's kind of an unstable environment, you know. I didn't really feel like, what is happening? It's just like, okay, well, I mean, he's reacting. Yeah. He's expressing, you know.
He's 19 years old or 18 years old. Yeah. Yeah, that was another part of it. It was, you know, he's young and he's figuring out who he is. And by the way, I don't know if he kept the money. I don't know if he donated the money to the church. He's that kind of kid.
Sure.
So he may well have. But interestingly, you know, he's been to college now for a couple of years, and it gave him a little bit of perspective on it. And I was really thrilled that he was able – that he felt fine about participating in the finale of the show.
Yeah.
Because I would feel bad if he came away from the show just feeling like it was a bad experience for him or felt that he was contributing to something bad.
Oh, well, so let me ask you this then. How much – so you say, like – 3 chapters out of 27 in the book are about this experience.
Yeah.
What percentage of your experience on 2.5 Men was soiled? Was the whole experience soiled for you? Or does it just feel like, yeah, that was just 10% of it? Or how do you look back on it now?
No, I would say that the experience was vastly more positive than negative. Vastly more. I can't give a percentage.
Sure.
But no, first of all, you know, we had 6 or 7 great years just in the original run, and then sort of resurrecting the show was a fascinating, really difficult experience, but great, and I learned so much. And you know, in the end, it is actually the longest running multi-camera sitcom in the history of broadcast television. So we achieved something that we might, had there not been the drama, that might not have even been achieved.
Right.
You know, so. You know, yeah, there were some bad times. Yeah, now that the show is over, I have to say there is some amount of relief to be away from what was the source of a fair amount of drama in my life. But by and large, it was great. It was a great ride.
So rather than, because obviously, and I'm sure you've talked about it to death, and of course, and in the book too, it'll be, when people ask you, you can be like, in the book. But you know, like, rather than focusing on the negative, like, what are some of the positive takeaways? Like, what were you excited about, or what are you the most proud of, or what?
I was the most proud of being able to build a character for 12 years, you know, and take him through a lot of interesting turns and you know, from the sort of emotional basket case to the craven, craven sort of self-involved guy who he ended up becoming. You know, it was a huge education in comedy and working with writers and watching how the writers dealt with bringing Ashton in and seeing how they changed his characters and what arcs worked and what arcs didn't. And it was just all that, you know, it was the learning process of doing a show for a long time that I find incredibly valuable, because it's alchemy when you do it well, you know, and so watching people do it well for 12 years was great.
Do you, when you finished, did you feel relief or did you feel like, I really want to do this for another 12 years? Or were you ready to sort of like, I want to go do other stuff?
I was ready to move on, but sad because I love the people. You know, the people were great to me, a great crew.
That's a considerable portion of your life.
And yes, exactly. It was 12 years. You know, I've been doing this for 30, but 12 is a good chunk, you know? and just the incredible luck of having had a run like this is crazy. And I didn't want to take it for granted. But I made a decision in our last season that, and I was really grateful that I knew it was the last season, because that gave me a long time to emotionally prepare for it being over. But I decided I was not going to be sad until the end. I was not going to allow the fact that I knew it was going to be over to ruin the last year I was there. And it was great. I don't really start crying until the very last shot of the very last scene.
I mean, you can't. How could you not at that point?
Yeah. No. Then yeah. And it was a weird moment because after you shoot a scene, invariably the writers work on some new stuff. They bring it to you, and then you play that again in front of the audience. And sometimes you can just keep doing that. They'll keep, if they can't find a joke that works, they'll just keep working it, and you can be there for, 45 minutes working on a 2-minute scene, but that happens sometimes. But when we shot the very last scene, they said cut, and I looked and I could see the writers weren't working on new lines. They were hugging each other. Aww. And I was like, oh, we're done. Aww, we're shit. Really done.
You almost want to keep flubbing.
Yes,
the
exactly.
joke. Like, we're
exactly.
gonna, we can make it forever. So what, ideally now, like, what kind of stuff do you want to do? And what would, do you want to explore a lot of different types of new things, or do you want to take time off and enjoy the fact that the book's coming in?
I don't know. What do you think I should do?
I'll tell you what I think.
Okay, tell me.
I'll tell you what I think you should do.
Okay.
And this is just my personal opinion. I would find to me, Cranston is the perfect model for like really interesting longevity, because he will never repeat the thing that he did before. Mm-hmm. And so I honestly think I think you could land and just be some really cool, intense character in like a weird drama, like just like one of those really weird cable dramas where you have all of the creative freedom that is super interesting and super cool, or film, just like mm-hmm.
It'd be great. I'm trying to just keep my eyes open and not rush into anything.
Sure,
if something great crosses the transom, yeah, I love it. I'll jump on board. But
you're
I'm not
in such a good position, though.
I know, it's nice.
Because you financially, you probably don't really have to do anything. You could just do stuff that's fun. It doesn't matter. You just make yourself happy.
I kind of always was that way. I was lucky enough that I saved my money for my first few jobs, so I did not. So I always had a cushion. So I never was taking jobs because I had to until my son was born. That was when I started taking jobs because I had to. But before that, I was just doing – I was – it's like Tony Danza's going to kill me shirtless. Yeah, count me in, and that was fun, and that was a great way to work. And, nobody saw that movie, but I'm learning. I'm learning something new every day, and that's great. But you're right. That actually sort of gets me back to that point where I can do that again. Except I've got kids now, so
sure.
I'm gonna try not to embarrass them completely.
Well, to be honest, you have to embarrass them a little bit. I mean, I think isn't that part of the joy of being a parent is kind of embarrassing your kids?
Yeah, I guess so. Now
because
that you mention it
doesn't matter what you do because you're their parents.
They will find it embarrassing.
Between 5 and 18. They're gonna get more and more. No, I'm gonna say between 11 and 18.
Yeah,
they're gonna be more and more embarrassed of you because that's what they're supposed to do.
Oh, my dad cured Ebola. What a
god! Get it, Dad. That's what you should do, is go cure Ebola.
Yes.
Who would?
I know. Who would expect that? That would come out of left field.
I mean,
the guy from Two and a Half Men.
Fucking take that, Cranston.
Because this is all about getting.
Oh, you
Cranston.
Did Walter White. I cured Ebola. What are you gonna do about it?
Yours, Cranston.
John, it's Chris. Cranston just cured cancer.
Oh, God damn it!
Cranston! Just create an arch nemesis out of Cranston. Like one of the nicest guys.
Yes, exactly.
But I've always, the handful of times I've run into you at events over the years, you've always been so nice. I mean, it's just like, and not in a fakey, just like a genuinely like, hey, like you, what is it about your
what
upbringing?
What is wrong with you?
Well, because having been in the business for 30 years, it's like people don't always emerge and, there can be bitterness there, even successful people.
Wait, so, there's successful bitter people?
Crazy.
What?
Yeah, you've seen them. But how, what was it about your upbringing or your personality or whatever that you think kept you just like a nice regular dude?
Early on, I realized that if you love how stupid the business is, and it is stupid,
yeah,
and it's unfair, if you can love that, then every day is a gift, you know. And I'm serious. I love it. I, you know, when it was great to me, I loved it. When it was shitty to me, I loved it. And because it was always entertaining, you know, so that has sort of kept me through it all. And even the things I've done that have just failed, I found something in. You know, I found some kernel of something I'd learned in it.
Yeah. Do you ever think about, I'm going to go direct a bunch of television, or which is a pretty sweet life?
You know, I'd love to. Well, it's hard. It's hard to get that. You got like Ridley Scott directing a pilot. How do you compete with that? You know, I mean, I have directed some multi-camera. I would love to direct single camera. But, you know, if I don't know that, I think I would pursue trying to find another character to play before I would pursue directing. I don't know. Maybe. We'll see.
Is there another, do you have other ideas? Because I would imagine at this point, you probably could just go pitch your own thing to someone.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so what, do you have other character ideas, like other things that you would like to play, or other things you want to explore?
Not right now. I'm kind of trying to, you know, once the show was done, I kind of wanted to be a blank slate and not think about stuff. I'm not that guy who has, I got a million things I want to do right now. I wanted to chill out and not think about that. And, you know, the book coming up has been a fun sort of sidetrack, because I, you know, it's a weird... It puts you in a position of weird vulnerability, commodifying a portion of your life and handing it out and saying, please buy this and enjoy it. You know,
yes.
It's very odd. And so I'm learning from that experience right now. And so I've kind of suspended my imagination of what kind of characters I'm going to play.
The fortunate thing is that as a comedy guy, you can work the rest of your, like, you just have to be fun. Like, as long as you're, you know
yeah.
what I mean? Like, as long as you can, there's no, like, you could, if you wanted to, just take a decade off and then you could come back and still work.
Yeah. Well, one would hope. Although some people feel like comedy is a young man's game. Now, do you feel the same way?
I feel like comedy is, yes.
Or rather, young person's game.
I think comedy, and I'm noticing you have to split in a second.
Oh, yes,
okay,
I do.
But I think comedy is a hungry person's game.
I agree.
And I think that hunger is more common in young people, but, you know, when you meet people like Mel Brooks, Joan Rivers, like people who are in their 80s.
And still hilarious.
But because they were still hungry. And when people choose comfort over discomfort, when they choose... You know, like, I'm okay. I don't really need anything else. Totally fine choices.
Yeah.
But that's when the hunger goes away, and comedy really is a hungry man's game.
And that, and I'll tell you.
A hungry person's game.
Yes, exactly.
It is a hungry person's game. Maybe not be gender specific, but it is a hungry person's game.
Yeah, and that is one of the reasons that, like I will always love Eddie Murphy, and I will always love everything, but I don't know that he's hungry anymore. I think that's why he sort of backs away from it, you know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, I had heard that he did a stand-up set, and I hope that's true. You know, because it makes me. I would love for him to want to do.
And
that.
I know it's not fair.
But I don't blame him.
Of course,
it's like, if that's his life. It's very
selfish to pick your favorite performers and go do this.
Yes,
but you know, when you see Eddie Murphy in Bowfinger, you're like, do that again,
exactly,
because you're so good.
Exactly. Yeah. So we miss you, Eddie, and I
come home. Just so, but before you leave, just in a couple lines. I saw it in the theaters, but I don't remember it. But the title sticks out of my head. What was Morgan Stewart's Coming Home?
Oh, Morgan Stewart's Coming Home was a movie that was originally made as a home front, and it was a youth comedy about a kid whose dad is a senator and is running for re-election, and invites his kid, who he's never paid any attention to, back home to try and create the image of a family man, even though their family's really screwed up. And it was supposed to be a sort of a black comedy about this kid ruining his dad's Senate career. But it was we shut down a week into filming. They fired the director, totally rewrote the script.
That's appreciating the stupid part of the business.
Exactly. And then they then Ferris Bueller came out, was a huge hit. So they said, okay, how can we sort of fake that title? And it became Morgan Stewart's Coming Home.
Did you audition for Ferris Bueller?
I did not. I was doing Pretty in Pink at the time. And at the time, they were talking about me doing Some Kind of Wonderful
right
after that. That was the plan at the time, was that I was going to do Some Kind of Wonderful. And so, no, I did not.
So here's a suggestion.
Okay.
If you wanted to, you could afford to just reshoot Some Kind of Wonderful and put yourself.
I like how you think. If I could find that original script, it was so different than what they ended up with. Oh, you're right. I love it. I love that idea.
Okay, good. I think we can announce now.
We have
John
a plan.
Pryor is officially rebooting Some Kind of Wonderful with himself. Of course, everyone else will be like 17 years old.
But you'll
still be a high school. But you'll still be a high school guy in it, though. Don't explain it.
No explanation whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, that was sort of Hiding Out, too, was another one where you go back.
Yes, now that you mention it.
Loved that movie.
Oh, thank you, man.
Annabeth Gish, right?
Yes.
Fucking God, I have an encyclopedic knowledge of
80s. Yes, it's
movies.
Impressive. It's very impressive.
But I know you have to, you're in the middle of a book thing, and we have to let
I must
you
go.
Go.
Yes, I apologize.
But when is the book come out?
It's already out.
It is out.
Yes.
What is the official title of the book?
It is So That Happened.
So That Happened, John Cryer. It's so lovely to sit down and talk to you, and wonderful that you took the time to come in and talk about stuff.
The pleasure is mine, man, and I've been a fan of yours forever, since your stand-up and all that stuff. There is a Crispix joke of yours that I just love.
Oh,
how the earth is corn on one side, rice on the other.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, the Crispix.
That resonated with me, man.
I appreciate that. People would get offended by that a lot of times.
Why?
When I saw the joke, I go, rice on the other, because I thought I was making a racial statement.
Oh,
I'm like,
geez.
No, guys, there is literally
rice.
Our
on
economy
one side
is based on corn. The other side of the planet is a rice-based economy. That's not a.
Exactly.
That's just agriculture. It's an agriculture joke. And then by that point, the hook is dragging me. Yeah. You people don't understand agriculture. But thank you. I appreciate that. Oh. And it is wonderful to see you.
Well, the pleasure is mine.
And enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Okay.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.